I have Naomi Granvold here in the studio with me. Welcome, Naomi.
Thank you.
You went on a medical mission to Cambodia, but what got you there? What's your background and what led you to that?
Well, interestingly enough, and sadly enough, trauma has been one of my subspecialties that I deal with. I've been a psychiatrist for many years now. I'm retiring in about 10 days. But but trauma is always in the news. I mean, it's been in the news in Boston now.
Yes.
A lot of people are going to have post-traumatic stress syndrome, and if not the whole syndrome, not everybody goes that far into it, but traumatic kinds of symptoms, and they can last a long time and be very intrusive and troubling.
And is that, basically it's something that can start immediately or it can start later on? There's a real variable in that?
There is some variability, mm-hmm. Yeah. Certain symptoms might start sooner. It depends on how close you are to whatever tragedy there is in Cambodia. Most of the tragedy that the aftermath that I was seeing in some of the patients that I saw there were related to the Cambodian genocide in the 75 to 79, 79 during the Pol Pot regime. I have done one prior medical mission to Peru a year ago in February, and last summer was looking online to see where else I could do something where they take psychiatric people to help on medical missions. And so I came across this organization, the Cambodian Health Professionals Association of America, and they're based in Long Beach. And so I did go on the mission with them the last week of February, first week of March. It was fascinating. There were about 150 people. There were only three mental health people.
Mm. How is that broken down out of that 100-odd people? How is that broken down in terms of who goes?
There are many, many medical professionals as well as many support people. Mm. And, of course, we needed translators. And the translators were Cambodian medical students, and they were just delightful and very interested and very bright and extremely helpful. So they learned a lot by being translators for us. There were a contingent of surgeons because we were based at a place where there's both clinic and hospital setting in southern Cambodia. And so they did a number of surgeries. There were internists, primary practice people, a contingent of dental people. There were nurses, public health people, and pediatricians, and there were pharmacists. And then there were so many people that were needed just for crowd control and all kinds of other things. Okay. It's amazing how many different tasks there are to be done to help support the mission. And everybody was enthusiastic and friendly. I didn't know anybody before I left for the mission. And what a wonderful, terrific group of people that just have such kind hearts and open hearts and want to do this kind of work. So it was a real pleasure to be able to be part of this group.
So they came from literally all over America?
Well, most of the people were from Long Beach, and that's where this organization is based. There was a contingent from Northern California that left from San Francisco, and then there were a smattering of people from other parts of the country.
Oh, excellent. So that's good to have that mix as well.
Yeah, yeah. So it was very, very interesting.
So to go back again, you're a psychiatrist and you've practiced many years. Obviously, you're retiring.
Right.
What type of fields have you worked in, just to get some of your background?
Sure. I've been in practice altogether for about 33 years, and I did my residency down in San Mateo County doing community mental health. And I started a private practice, which I had for about 10 years after I finished my residency. And I was one of the few women psychiatrists in San Mateo County at that time. It was in the late 70s, or early 80s, I guess it was, at that point after the residency. And I first got interested in dealing with people who were traumatized because, by default, I was getting a lot of referrals into my private practice of women who had been raped. Mm. And the post-traumatic stress disorder diagnosis was, I don't remember if it was already acknowledged at that point or just being acknowledged, but I was sort of flying by the seat of my pants. But I learned a lot in listening to these women about trauma and reactions to trauma, and read about it and worked with the rape crisis team. And then concurrent with my practice down there, I was also for a few years the medical director of a Woodside Women's Hospital. And we saw women who, some who had been traumatized, eating disorders or substance abuse. And then I just had a variety of people in my practice. And I moved up to Sonoma County in, I think it was 91. And had a little private practice here for about 3 years. And then I've been at Kaiser Permanente for almost 20 years now. And have had the opportunity there of, again, working with a wide range in the adult population. Also with people who have been traumatized. And did a lot of consulting in the critical care unit. And was part of starting a critical incident response team at Kaiser for adverse, you know, traumatic events that may have happened at the hospital or to people who work there. So it's been very, very interesting.
Yes.
And more recently, I've been working a lot with women and their babies, women who may have been traumatized or just have depression, and it affects their mothering ability. So I have a small group that's been running for a couple of years with women and their babies. So it's been a very interesting career.
Indeed. Thank you for doing such things. That's, it's so, as we know, mental health is severely neglected in this state and country. You've seen it over these years. Is it coming out of that? Is there more acknowledgement of mental, you know, the need for mental health? Is the budget skewing that way? What's happening in that realm?
Well, I think there is more recognition of need, and that's very positive. I think mental health is usually terribly underfunded, as most people know, because it's hard to get help. And the programs are not well funded, much, you know, very underfunded compared to most other medical specialties. It's always sort of like the stepchild. But there's less stigma, though. People are not as ashamed to say they have certain feelings or that they see a therapist or that they're on medications for a variety of mental illness kinds of issues. And so it's wonderful that some of the stigma is not as present. But people, when they have difficult feelings, unhappy feelings, the feelings that they think are different or thoughts that they think are different from what other people have, they are very reluctant to talk about it. Mm-hmm. But most of the time, if they can find a professional to talk with, they realize that they are not the only person. So then they don't feel isolated. They don't feel like there's something really wrong with them. And I've always tried to emphasize when I do see patients that no matter what their diagnosis is, the bottom line is that they're a human being. Mm. They have feelings, they have relationships, they have thoughts, and they need to see themselves as bigger than a depression or bigger than being bipolar or bigger than being schizophrenic, that they're a human being. And one aspect for their story of being a human being is their mental illness. But that's not the whole definition of who they are as a person.
Yes, indeed. Has the profession and mental health treatment skewed to the drug treatment more rather than that personal treatment? How is that split up?
There's a mix. When I was in private practice, I did a lot of therapy and medications. Usually at a larger organization, the psychiatrists do more medication management. And then the other therapists, psychologists, social workers, do more of the therapy in the groups. I have been fortunate and able to be able to do a couple of groups while I've been there. But I don't think that you can really prescribe medications without knowing what's going on with the person. Because somebody comes in and they say, well, I'm more depressed. So I could just say, oh, that's too bad. Let's raise the dose of your antidepressant. Or I can say, well, what's happened? You know, they tell me they've only been last month, they're more depressed. So you say, well, what's happened? And most frequently, there's something going on in their lives. Mm-hmm. So if they can understand that, if they can understand the relationship, then they can understand that they don't necessarily need to have more medication or another medication. They need to be able to understand what's going on and talk with somebody about it, being part of a treatment program, which frequently can be a group program, which some of them are just excellent. So I think that, again, you have to relate to the whole person, even if you're mostly prescribing medications, to have a relationship with them, because it's not all about medications. There's such a mind-body interaction, and that has to be paid attention to.
Yes. Yeah, thank you for that explanation of that. Because it does seem very mysterious, looking in from the outside,
right.
How that's done and the whys. So obviously, you go, the world here in California, and you go to Cambodia. And what town did you go, and where was it?
Well, we originally flew into Phnom Penh, which is the capital, but where we did our work was in the southern province of Takao in Cambodia, in southern part of Cambodia, and it was a small city there, and they did have a community hospital, and that's where we were set up.
Community hospital, meaning how many beds, or did you ever...
I don't know how many beds. It was not terribly large. I don't think most of us would want to be there if we were ill. It was very hot and humid. There's no air conditioning. Mm. There's no fans. The sanitary conditions are atrocious. Mm. The restrooms for the patients are really holes in the floor.
Yeah.
In a bathroom area. The beds are metal frame beds with wooden slats. No mattresses, no sheets. Mm. The patients bring in these, or the family brings in these thin straw mats that they put on the beds, and they often sit on the bed with the patient. There's no hospital gowns. Mm. They're wearing their street clothes. I mean, it's very, very
unsanitary,
yeah. And somewhat primitive. I think that the care that they give, I'm sure the people are very well-meaning in giving the care, and some of the care is probably very good. There's a whole contingent of people that we saw masses of people would line up before, starting early in the morning, and we treated 800 to 1,000 people a day in the 6 days that we were there for the clinic. And we saw a number of mental health people, not as much. But again, when you ask, is mental health acknowledged? There were three of us, and I daily went around to the pediatricians. I went to the family practice area that was set up. I went to the dental area, and I said, we're set up over here in the breezeway. There were like a few plastic chairs with a little awning over it, and that was our mental health site, and people walked through it freely, so there was not much confidentiality. Yeah. But that's what we had, and I would say, send us people. And then once they realized we were there and what we could do, we started getting a lot of referrals. Mm. And I also tried to emphasize there's a lot of cultural idioms of how people present with medical problems there.
Oh, yes.
And what they might say. So if somebody comes in, they say they're dizzy, and we can talk about this more, but if they say they're dizzy, well, there weren't probably any neurologists that I know of there, but you might think, well, they've got maybe something with their blood pressure or something else is going on with their heart or neurological problems. But dizziness for a Cambodian, not always, I'm sure, but frequently, is an idiom meaning that they are anxious. They may be having panics. It means that their mind is going around in circles, making them, as a metaphor, dizzy. Hmm. And a lot of times this is related to trauma. And so I said, if somebody comes in saying those things, send them to us. And same thing with certain other kinds of things that really indicated more mental health issues than medical issues.
The medical. Interesting. So you have to really ferret and tease out the... that need,
right.
Almost interesting. Now,
and we didn't use any medications there at all because there would be no follow up, and it needs to, they don't work immediately. You have to take it for periods of time. So, I mean, we can talk about some of the patients that I saw and what we would do, but basically, what we could do is listen to them, and then talk a lot about the mind body relaxation and how they can instill something positive in their own heart, and how to learn to smile when they can think of that.
Mm. Well, let's roll back the years and give some people, Cambodia, everyone has vague memories of it. It was associated somehow in the Vietnam War. Can you give us a brief history can be reminded what happened there and really why they're still in this particular state?
I mean, I'm not that familiar with all the details of the history, but the Khmer people go back well over 1,000 years, and the French had it was a French colony for a long time. During the Vietnam War, The United States bombed along the border between Vietnam and Cambodia to disrupt the supply lines from North Vietnam through Cambodia to South Vietnam. And then during about from 75 to 79, Pol Pot was in power, and he basically decided he was a Maoist. And that's where they got the Khmer Rouge, the Red Khmer, the Communist Khmer. And basically, he wanted to have an egalitarian, agrarian society. So he emptied all the cities. There were floods of people within days. Major cities were emptied. People were marched out into all the fields in the surrounding areas of Cambodia, in the countryside. And they anybody that was intellectual, in quotes, was murdered just right off the top. They lost a whole generation of professionals, people who were doctors, people who were dentists, people who were engineers, people who were librarians or teachers, people who wore glasses because they thought that meant they were intellectual. So people would take their glasses off and smash them because, you know, to try and fit in with the poverty of the people that were streaming into the countryside. And then the conditions, there was really a genocide. The conditions were horrible. There were prisons. People were killed all the time. They were starved. They were very ill with malaria for months at a time. Their families were murdered in front of them. If they stole a potato, the person next to you in the rice paddy would just get clubbed in the back of the head, and they'd be dead, drowning there in the rice paddy. And if you even reacted, you know, you'd be dead too. So there was incredible trauma. And this went on for about 4 years, and it was a huge genocide. I think it was maybe a quarter of the population was killed, but somewhere between 2 and 3 million people died in those 4 years. And
was that an ethnic thing? You know, the Khmer, is there other ethnic groups?
Yeah, I'm not. Right? I think the main part of this was not necessarily ethnic. It was more sociological. Couldn't swear to that, but from my understanding is that it wasn't based on the person's religion or their ethnicity. It was more based on they want an egalitarian society where everybody is the same.
Wow.
And so there was no education of anybody during that period. And like I said, they lost most of the professional people who were there. And I saw people who had survived the Khmer Rouge, and they described how, you know, they usually had a lot of children. Many of their children did not survive. I've met a few Cambodians in Santa Rosa, where I live, who were very young at the time, but would tell me that they remembered some things about losing family members and what it was like during that period. It was a nightmare, like all Holocausts and all genocides are. It was right up there with all of that, yeah.
Indeed, a Holocaust, yes.
Yes.
So interesting background, and also to, I mean, what is the current situation there politically in Cambodia?
Right now they have an elected monarch. I'm not sure that much. I'm not really that educated about the whole government structure, though, whether that person is just more of a figurehead or active or not.
Because, yeah, I think, was it last year? I think one of the king or
Sihanouk
passed away. Didn't,
died, yeah, right, yes,
right,
yes. And there was, and when you visit the palace area in Phnom Penh, there's a huge place where they have his ashes that was built up there, and his picture is everywhere in Cambodia. Everywhere, Sihanouk's picture is there.
So they maintain that, yeah.
Yeah, picture of him and his wife, actually, yeah.
Interesting. So there's a sort of semi-royal. So they're just trying to position themselves away, I suppose, obviously from the communist, that's on the other side, from the communist side, I would think.
Right, yeah. I don't think that's a major influence at this point.
Not anymore, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so you landed in Cambodia. What a thing. How did you prepare?
Well, I realized as soon as I signed up for this trip that going there with my Western ideas was not going to be the way to go. First of all, I wouldn't be able to connect. They wouldn't respect me. They would not listen to anything, and they would probably just write us all off, especially in mental health. You know, medical is medical. Although, again, with the mind-body interaction, and they have a lot of of beliefs, and they go to these temples for certain rituals. So there's always, you know, I think it's important that anybody that goes has some idea of the cultural aspects. So I spent an enormous number of hours looking up research papers on mental health in Cambodia. And there's probably more research papers than there is mental health. There's very, very little. There's like a handful of psychiatrists in the whole country. Mm. And there are also some therapists there. But generally, people do not receive much mental health care. That's changing very, very slowly. But I realized that I needed to understand more about the culture. So I read a lot of articles, and a lot of the research that was done was done not necessarily in Cambodia, but in Massachusetts, a number of the studies, because there's a huge contingent of Cambodian refugees who have settled in Massachusetts and other places in the country. And the articles were very enlightening. And again, I learned a lot about some of the cultural idioms and what that means when people, for example, like a panic attack, many, many people listening to us know exactly what a panic attack is, and they've suffered them, and they're pretty upsetting, and they can be very intense, and a lot of people end up in the emergency rooms thinking they're having a heart attack, but usually it consists of like a very intense immediate onset of anxiety. You might feel tremulous, your heart might be racing, you might be sweating, you feel like you're smothering, you can't breathe, sometimes you have to leave where you're at, and you really feel you're going to die. There's a sense you're going to die. And it's very intense and very frightening, and it can build on itself, because once you have one, any little signal can set off another one. Mm. But physiologically, there's all this neurohormonal kinds of a contingent, a physiological contingent to it, which is very well studied and understood. So no matter what culture you're in, a panic attack physiologically is a panic attack.
Okay.
But something that I learned that was very interesting is that there's a belief of in the Cambodian culture, and I saw this in a number of articles, that there's a wind substance. And they have a Cambodian name for it, but I don't know how to pronounce it correctly.
A wind substance.
And it's this wind substance that is in their body, and it travels alongside the blood vessels. And it gets released through the hands, the feet. And if the wind is blocked, then it sort of is a reflux all the way up through the body and up into the neck. Mm-hmm. And part of an anxiety attack is also your muscles might hurt because you're anxious, you're tense, the tight muscles and everything, they can ache. So they have body aches and pains. And again, it comes on suddenly. It's their equivalent of a panic attack. But their metaphor and their visualization of what's happening in the body is peculiar to the Cambodian culture. So it was I'm really glad that I understood that, because I could ask people some of these symptoms and they could answer me. But they feel that this wind gets backed up and it gets up into their neck and their throat, and they have this image that the vessels in their neck are going to pop open and they're going to bleed to death.
Oh my goodness.
They were going to have a stroke. So it was important to understand that imagery. Another one is they have a phenomenon called, well, that we call orthostatic panic attacks. And that's related to the fact that orthostatic is when you stand up too fast, sometimes you feel a little dizzy.
Oh, yeah.
So, because it takes a few seconds sometimes for your blood pressure to adjust. For a number of people that survived the Khmer Rouge, again, that has a very different kind of a meaning. And that's where the orthostatic panic comes in, where if somebody stands up too fast and they experience this dizziness, what comes to them, it becomes a panic attack. It's not just a fleeting dizziness like we might have. Because again, the people that were in the rice paddies and starving and ill with malaria and fevers and weak from starvation, they could barely stand up, and yet they had to work in the rice paddies, and they were always in fear of death, and they were grieving for all the people around them that were murdered and loss of all their loved ones. They were hit over the head. They had to carry heavy loads like on a pole across the back of their neck. Oh, yeah. So their necks were strained.
Right.
And they felt dizzy because they were so weak. So when they feel dizziness, the automatic reaction is a panic attack, because it brings them back to, it's reminiscent of these times. And conscious, they may not even realize it, but some of them may actually have flashbacks. Wow. So again, it's interesting how the cultural aspects are so, so very important here.
Well, that's it. When you were sitting in that little breezeway then and you were getting people to sit down, how that those first interactions were, because you obviously had an interpreter, and how did that work? That must have been quite interesting for you and for them on both sides.
It was challenging. I think that I would encourage anybody who wants to and can to go on these kinds of missions. The Cambodian people were very gentle and very kind people. The people we saw were really very, very poor. I'm sure there's not everybody is, but a lot of people are in poverty there. So you have to get used to the conditions. It was very hot and humid, and we were in the areas between the buildings and the hospital complex with awnings. So there was no real breeze or anything. And it was very primitive. There were no exam rooms. Most of the people, even the primary care people, were set up in these long tables, and they would just examine the people as much as they could. They'd listen to their heart and their lungs, et cetera. So we had a setup with just a few chairs in this breezeway, and there were two of us that were doing most of the interviewing and therapy kinds of things, along with an interpreter. So I would introduce myself. I would try to always be looking into the eyes of the person that I was seeing. I would first say through the interpreter, well, the interpreter would interpret, of course, I would say, thank you for coming and, and being willing to talk with us or talk with me today. How can I help you? What's going on for you? And most of the time, I'd try as much as possible to have eye contact with them and to talk in a very soothing and gentle and compassionate voice, and to be looking at them. They could see the expression on my face. And I really believe that more than anything I said or did is that they knew they were being listened to, that I cared about them. And I think this whole issue of I can talk about what we actually finally said with them to help them, but bearing witness to their pain. And not that everybody there was traumatized. There were a lot of different kinds of psychiatric issues that presented. But no matter what it was, issue that was presented, bearing witness, they don't talk much about their emotions there. So just having somebody listen to them for a half hour or 40 minutes, however long we might have spent, was an incredible experience. Having somebody care and then being able to tell their story, and somebody else bearing their story or their emotional pain or trauma or whatever. It was very, very powerful.
It must have been. And how was that, getting that out of them? Was it they were reluctant at first, or they really did it flood out? How were the reactions to you?
I was amazed at how open they were. They really wanted to talk, because when in the triage area, people didn't know there were going to be mental health people. They knew there was medical people there. Same thing happened when I'd gone to Peru. So we had to tell the people in triage, say, would you like to talk with somebody about anything, about feeling dizzy, or if you feel anxious or depressed? And all, but they had to be careful about the words. I talked with them about which words to use, because those words don't mean much to them. So, and then when I talked, went around to the other specialties to get referrals. But when they came, they really wanted to talk, so we didn't have to prod them. Mm. Sometimes they would go on and on and on, and we had to find ways to curtail some of the flood of information. Yeah. But the human connection was incredibly powerful, to just look in their face, for them to know somebody was listening. The expression on their face was just amazing to watch. It was like, in spite of the lack of privacy and the chaos all around us, we're just in these chairs in a breezeway and people are breezing by. But you just feel so connected to that other human soul that's sitting opposite you. Yeah. It was a very profound experience. And the people, and what we could do is listen. And the other part of what we could do, and this is what I was realizing from the research I did, is really emphasize the mind-body aspect. to talk with them about breathing and relaxation. We actually had some charts that showed the effects on the body of stress and anxiety, the effect on the heart and the blood pressure and pain and muscles being tight and all kinds of things. And they really got at the whole mind-body thing because that's how they feel. They don't think in terms of emotions. They think in terms of this unit, which I think is a very good way to think about it. Yeah. We can learn a lot.
It is all one, yeah.
And so we taught them some breathing and relaxation, talk with them about mind-body, and then I would have them sort of close their eyes and see if they could just picture something that was peaceful, something that was quiet for them, that they could recall on their own later on. And I asked them to see if there's a place inside them that they can hold that, and that when they can think about it and they can smile inside. Mm. And when people smile, when we smile, it's very hard to be angry. And I really think there's some neurological circuits that we're physiologically connected to parts of our brain where it's like a pleasure center. Because when you smile, it's very hard to feel as tense. You automatically relax.
Right.
And so when I would do that and they'd close their eyes for a few minutes, I would see them smile when I'd say that. And they visibly relaxed. Wow. And so that's what we could do for them.
Yes.
But the experience of that was very profound, even more than I would have expected. Because a lot of times the issue comes up of the ethics of going, you know, we swoop in and we do all this wonderful, heroic stuff and we leave. And there's a lot of people that question, you know, is this more damaging to do this kind of mission work than just not showing up at all? But after my experience with this, and you know, we can talk about a couple of cases if we have some time, I'm absolutely convinced that the people that we can reach, we helped. Mm-hmm. I wish we could reach more.
Well, that's all we can hope for, isn't it? Do what you can do as an individual. Wonderful.
The one wonderful other work. Thing I think that we could offer, and again, I learned this from my reading, is that most of them are Buddhist, and the people that lost people, especially during the Khmer Rouge, but also just other people where there may have been deaths, it's very important for them to have the body and cremate it and then have certain rituals in the temple. And, of course, there were millions of people that were killed, and they could never retrieve their bodies or even the bones from the killing fields. You don't know whose bones are whose in all these big mass graves. But I spoke with them frequently with most of the patients. I said, well, do you go to the temple? And those that do, I encourage them to continue. And there's certain rituals they do. And some of them had these little red bracelets, which means they had been to the temple. Mm. And it's a healing kind of a thing that they would wear these bracelets. So that was another very important part of understanding the culture, to encourage them. Because it's a very, very important process for them to be part of the temples there.
Yeah, it's an established institution which they can go to.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, are the hospitals private or public? How's that managed there?
I think there's a mixture. Some of them are private. A lot of them are public. And I did not see any of the private ones. But somebody that visited a private hospital, one of our group, said that the conditions weren't a whole lot better, which really surprised me. So it may have just been that hospital. I don't know.
So now, obviously, it gets down to people for you when you're in Cambodia. And I know you had some very, you know, really deep emotional experiences there just with some of the people that you met and helped treat. Mm-hmm. Perhaps you can give us an idea of what that was like.
Sure. I think I'm still processing. You know, I've been back 5.5 weeks now, still processing some of those experiences. And even speaking with some of the personnel that were on the trip, talking with them about their reactions to things. But one of the things, like you said, people are people. And I think that's one of the bottom lines, really, is to see these people, they're human beings. And we tend to think, oh, those people over there. And when you do this kind of work and you come in contact with other people, they want the same things. They want to be with their families. They want their loved ones. They want to be able to have enough to eat and to love people and feel cared about and not have to worry about being murdered or being victims of genocide and terror and that kind of thing. So there's similarities. There's some basic human traits that we all share. And I think it helps us bring the world closer. There was one case, though, that made a very big impact on me. There was a 14-year-old girl that had made, this was her third suicide attempt in 3 years. She'd eaten some rat poison, and she was brought into the hospital. Mostly we saw outpatients, but I did see this girl. And I saw her, and her grandmother was sitting by her bedside. And like I said, the very primitive conditions in this hospital, the ICU was just another room with all these beds in it. And she had an IV, and she was sort of sleepy, and I was going through an interpreter. So I asked her a bit about her family and what happened and what led to the suicide attempt, especially the third attempt. And there's a lot of things going on in her family. I had heard that there may have been some abuse with the father, but as I talked with her more, once or twice, he may have been physically abusive, but that was not the main thing. This act was precipitated because the dad didn't like how she cooked the rice. She didn't do a good job. It was really not edible, I guess, or something. And being a teenager, she was very insulted, and I'm sure that there's other verbal abusive things that were going on. It's not just this one little thing. And a teenager can be impulsive, and they don't know how to handle feelings. And so she decided that she would just have to die. So she ate the rat poison. She 2 years before that, I think she had attempted a hanging, and then the year before, she had had another attempt. I don't remember how. So she's lying in bed, and I talk with her through the interpreter, and her eyes are dull, and she's giving me these, you know, information. And I'm thinking, what am I going to do? You know, in the United States, we'd put her on a 72-hour hold, and she'd be in a psych hospital really soon.
Yeah.
But there is no such thing there. There's nothing you can do for that. So how do you keep somebody safe? And I thought the only thing I could do is maybe try and find something that's meaningful in her life that gives her self-esteem so she can hold on to that thought if she feels like there's nothing left and she has to kill herself. So when I started asking her, what's good in your life, you know, she told me that she was good in math. She helped other students. She sewed things. She was good at some sports. People liked her in school, so I got a list of things. The interpreter wrote it down in Cambodian so she could keep that. And it was like a miracle before my eyes. When she started talking, her eyes had a sparkle. Before that, she was like half asleep. Oh. And then her eyes like lit up. Her whole affect, her whole face, you know, it had expression in it. And she was more animated and excited about telling me these things. And so really we worked on that, about what can she do so that when she is feeling desperate, she can call upon these things that would help with her self-esteem, and there would be an out besides suicide. The grandmother, who was by her side the whole time, she was very supportive. And so I sort of tried to include the grandmother in that also, where, and you can, you know, talk with your grandmother. You go to her house, which was like right next door or something. So we talked then, and then the next night, I was away from the site at this other site, and it was 8 o'clock at night. I came back to talk with her again. She was in another room, but the grandmother popped up and said, "Oh no, we're in this room." When they saw me go by their room, and there was no interpreter. And the grandmother, though, and this girl were smiling, and the grandmother pulls up a chair next to this bed and, like, in motion, "Sit down, sit down." It was like I was family, you know?
Yeah.
And all I could smile, I was gesturing and trying to make a fool of myself, you know, trying to get some, you know, some thoughts across to her. She probably didn't understand a thing. And then the next morning I saw them again, and then the mom, the sister, and the grandmother and this girl were there, and I took a couple of pictures. They allowed me to do that. And they were so, so grateful. Mm. This girl has something now that she can pull on to get her through harder times. And the grandmother, I think, because she was witness and heard everything because it was all in translation, can be a really much bigger support. There is so many people that just touched my heart that I just hold there. And this little 14-year-old girl will always, you know, her face and her being will always be in my heart, and I'll always smile when I think of her. And there are just lots of stories like that, but
it's a two-way
go into all of it. But it was wonderful, and that's where I say there's only so many people we can help, but the ones we do, it matters.
Yeah. And it becomes a two-way street. You know, it's not just you giving to them. They're
absolutely,
you know, opening and giving to you. I mean, that's the beauty of it, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes.
Wow. So you were there how long?
I was there for 2 weeks altogether. The trip was about 2 weeks, but we were just doing the hospital thing for about 6 days.
Mm.
One story that I told to lots of people that I met who were on the mission is about a starfish. And some people may know the story and others may not. But I've known the story for years, and it never had such meaning, and it was so alive for me. There's different versions, but basically this elderly man is walking down the beach, and it's strewn with starfish, and they're stranded because the tide's out, and they're all going to die. You know, they're going to get dried out on the beach and die. So the man's picking up a starfish and tossing it into the ocean, and picking up another starfish and tosses it into the ocean. So this young man, or his boy, comes by, and he says, "What are you doing? This is hopeless. Look, there's millions of starfish on the beach. What are you trying to do? It doesn't matter." The old man picks up another starfish, tosses it into the sea, and he says, "It matters to this one." And he tosses another starfish. "It matters to this one." And that's what we can do. Yeah. And everybody can do that. We can't reach millions of people, maybe, but every individual can save another starfish.
Yes.
But the Cambodian people have a wonderful spirit, incredibly resilient after all they've been through, very kind and open-hearted, just a lovely people. And I'm so grateful that I had the opportunity to be there.
Some place you'd like to go back to?
I'm going to go on the mission again next year.
Yeah. Okay.
And I think I'm going to stay a little longer and maybe visit Cambodia and Thailand because they're all right there. But the more I reflect on this, the more powerful it has been for me. Mm-hmm. And I would love to, it'd be an honor, you know, to be able to go back and work with people again.
No, it's fantastic. I mean, that's to give like that is wonderful, all that expertise of all those years. And that's the thing, I suppose we have in the West, we have a very concentrated energy source of experience. And so you can give a lot in a short time, I would think.
And I learned so much from them about their culture and about, you know, again, these symbolic kinds of things. In the break, I had mentioned to you about their beliefs about spirits, that if you don't find the body and cremate it, that they believe in reincarnation. And that the spirit wanders, and the spirit can't be reborn if it didn't have certain temple rituals or wasn't cremated, etc. So part of the trauma that a lot of these people who were genocide survivors experienced are these recurrent dreams. And sometimes the evil spirits, because the spirits of their loved ones couldn't be reincarnated, and sometimes they would be peaceful anyway, but sometimes they would be evil spirits. And a lot of the people having these bad dreams, these nightmares, would believe that the spirits could catch them and they would die in their sleep. And there are people that have, there were these killing fields, and a lot of the population was able to get a little bit of the dirt from these, there were these mass graves, and where they dug up, you know, the bones of millions of people. And you can't find your own relatives' bones, but they would be able to get a little bit of the dirt, and they would bring it to the temple, and they'd be able to bury it in the temple. And they believed that at least that, even if who knows if it was their own relative, was bits and pieces were in that bit of dirt, but they were helping somebody's spirit being reborn.
Yes.
And it's just a beautiful way to think about things.
You know, that's that human thing of how do we recover? I mean, that's your job, isn't it? How, you know, recover from trauma and ongoing things. That's an incredible job you do. But you know, in your retiring in 20 days, you said?
10 days.
10 days. So what plans?
Well, I am going to sleep in because I've never been a morning person. I have two wonderful daughters that I adore that I'm going to see more of. And I have a horse that I ride, which has been my source of mental health because I am in a different world of spirits when I am riding. And I want to travel more and see friends I just don't have time to see as much as I'd like to, and go on some more medical missions.
Wonderful, wonderful.
So it's I'm looking forward to that.
Well deserved. Oh, now you have some websites and email addresses and things of various organizations. Perhaps you could let everyone know.
Sure. If anybody's interested in doing the mission, the organization is called Cambodian Health Professionals Association of America. You can just Google it. And it's CHPAA, just put that in, and that will come up. And they're located in Long Beach, California. if you just want to learn more about the culture and what's going on in Cambodia with regard to services that are, again, when we were seeing people that were being victims of domestic violence, et cetera, there's no place for these people to go. So they're working on that very slowly. But there's something, an organization called Transcultural Psychosocial Organization of Cambodia. It's TPO Cambodia. You can just put in the Google. There's also something called the Extraordinary Chambers in the Courts of Cambodia. Mm. And that you could just Google ECCC. And again, that has a lot of things about outreach programs and everything that are going on in Cambodia. It also has information about the courts there that have been trying to bring the perpetrators of the genocide to justice. So far, only one person has been imprisoned. And one thing that keeps the trauma... One.
Millions died in one person?
Millions died, but to those who were lost, it seems like everything.
Yep.
And there's been trials of several people, but it's a very difficult thing to do because on these sites also there's information where they talk about how the people are living side by side by the former Khmer Rouge. Mm. They live in the same villages. So it's very, very difficult to bring these people to trial. Yeah. Repercussions and bringing your neighbor or testifying against your neighbor. And there's a lot of really interesting kinds of testimony and things that are on both of those sites, the ECCC site and the TPO site. And then there's several books. I met one of the very few survivors of this terrible torture prison that we had visited in Phnom Penh. It's called, his name is Bo Ming. It's B-O-U-M-E-N-G, a survivor from the Khmer Rouge prison, S-21. And so it's about him. That's the title of the book. There's another book that I had read years ago called First They Killed My Father, A Daughter of Cambodia Remembers. And the author of that is Luong. It's L-O-U-N-G. UNG. UNG is the last name. I'm not pronouncing it right, I'm sure. There's a movie that was amazing but difficult to watch called Killing Fields a number of years ago. It was based on a true story of a reporter from the New York Times and his assistant. The assistant was the actor that played the assistant was actually a real-life Cambodian physician who survived the Khmer Rouge, lost a lot of his family that were killed. Or died during that period, and he immigrated to New York. He acted this other part in this movie, and he was killed a number of years ago. And the circumstances, I think, is just a gang killing. But there's some rumors, if you read things, that maybe he was active in trying to bring the genocide perpetrators to justice. And there's some rumors that maybe this was a way to keep him quiet.
Right. Right. A lot of possibilities in that, all credible as well, unfortunately.
The Killing Fields evidently is extremely true to life, very powerful movie. I'm sure it can be rented. It was an older movie.
Well, Naomi Granvold, thank you for relating your experiences on your trip to Cambodia and the ramifications of it to a lot of people's lives, including your own.
Very much my own, yes.
And, and congratulations again on retiring. And
thank you.
Lots of wonderful future fun and also great work back in Cambodia.
Thank you. And thank you so much for having me here tonight. It's been a real pleasure and just hope that people are inspired to save some more starfish.
Yes, indeed.
Because everybody can do that. Everybody.
Yeah. Keep throwing them back.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's another life saved.
Thank you so much, Naomi.
Thank you.
Thank you. Oh my-